And now that you're listening to the happy music, it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and we're back around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. How's everybody?
The gang.
The gang.
The gang's all here.
Hey.
How about we go the other way around? Glenn, who in the heck are you?
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Real books and comic books, as you mentioned last week.
Mm, yes. Gotcha.
How about you, Trey?
Trey Graham. I'm the movies editor at NPR.org and Linda's own backstop right there at Monkey Seat.
That's true, he is. And how about you, Stephen?
I am Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
And also my pal.
And also Linda's pal.
Awesome.
And the rest are what then?
You know what?
You're also my pals.
Oh, good.
But think about it this way.
You all are qualified to be here aside from being my pal. Chris Thompson.
Right. Oh, yeah. Technically, my credentials are I'm Linda's pal, and also I am at NPR Music.
That's right. Well, I am currently in recovery from the fact that, as readers of the blog know, I was at the rally to restore sanity and or fear. And as I mentioned on Twitter, my best summary of the day would be that the rally to restore sanity did not quite measure up to the hot bath to re-restore sanity after the rally to restore sanity.
Yeah, I have to say that when there was that first policy announcement about, you know, you might want to steer clear of this if you're not assigned to cover it, which was the official NPR policy.
Right.
I, like any self-respecting Washingtonian, went, thank God.
You went, duh.
Does that mean I can't march into hundreds of thousands of people and eight porta-potties?
Yeah. Hey, it was surprisingly grueling.
I like to think that when NPR was trying to sort out, like, you know, who are we going to send to cover this momentous occasion,
yes,
that they took a show of hands with the question, who loves crowds?
Who loves crowds? So this is a week where we're just going to kind of catch up on some things that have sort of randomly come up over the last week. Perhaps we could all have gotten together and agreed to see Saw 3D this weekend. But we didn't because I chose the horror of a crowd of 200,000 people.
In hindsight.
Instead, in hindsight, wrong decision. Okay, so here's my first question for everybody. This Friday is the opening of 127 Hours, which is the James Franco movie about the guy who gets trapped under a rock. And I don't think it's a spoiler to say the entire reason they're making this movie is that after being trapped under a rock for, I'm going to guess, 127 hours.
That's what I'm thinking. Yep, yep.
He cut his arm off. Now, yes. I don't think they'd be making the movie otherwise, right?
That is correct, yes.
I don't think guy trapped under rock and then there's
And then suddenly trapped.
And then someone found him.
He gets
yes.
out.
And then
right.
an avalanche loosens the rock.
Yeah, I don't think that's... If he just suddenly goes... then eventually he just moves it.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a movie with James Franco.
No.
He's only getting the movie because the arm.
Because he
right?
cut his arm off and lived to tell the tale.
So are we going to see this movie? Do you have interest in this movie?
Oh, sure.
Yeah? On what basis? True story, James Franco?
True story, James Franco, excellent buzz, and because it's not about the guy cutting his arm off.
You don't think it is?
Of course not.
What do you think it's about?
It's about the guy cutting his arm off like Titanic is about the fact that the ship sinks.
Which it is, right?
No,
right.
Of course
that
not.
Happens.
About the
I remember that happening in Titanic.
So it's actually going to be...
Spoiler alert.
So while he's trapped under the rock, he's going to draw a girl naked. And
yes, exactly. And there's going to be steamy windows.
Yeah.
Right.
Steamy windows.
Yep.
So
a lot of people shouting, Jack Rose. Jack Rose. Jack Rose for 40 minutes.
Arm, James Franco. Arm, James Franco.
You're sick. You're sick, sick people. I guess my question was, when you make a movie like this, and you know it's going to be basically a one-man, as I understand it, it's basically a one-man show, since it's not like he's trapped under the rock with a lot of friends, right?
But even in the trailer, you're seeing a lot of flashbacks, right? So it's about you getting to know who this guy is, and they're going to tell you that in a series of hallucinations.
So
right?
this isn't like...
While he's going mad and getting ready to cut his arm off.
This isn't like Lifeboat or the...
Oh, I think it's... Yes, I think it's exactly the same sort of thing.
Like Buried.
You're going to... Yeah, it's like Buried. It's like Lifeboat. It's like a whole series of things, which I think Bob Mondello did an essay about recently, where the filmmakers have put a sort of restriction on themselves and are finding creative ways to tell the story around that.
But it also happens to
have the advantage of being true.
Yeah, I guess the reason why I was curious about this is that we live in a world of such spoiler phobia, and people are so convinced that you have to be surprised by everything
right.
that happens in a movie, that it kind of surprises me that you can make a movie where the entire premise of the movie is, this is the one about the guy who at the end is going to cut his arm off.
Yeah, but I mean, you could say the same thing about United 93. I mean,
right.
you know how United 93 right. ends.
And into
still
thin air.
Movie.
And,
yeah,
right.
that's
into
true.
Into thin air. I mean, it's kind of right there in the title. Into thin air. I mean, it's kind of giving away a lot. People who went to see Passion of the Christ knew how that was going to end.
That's right.
So, I mean, you know. The fact that's that it's based on a true story doesn't add any cachet for me at all. In fact, it kind of takes away some of it because I just find that I go to movies, I go to books, I like fiction. I like jumping into somebody else's head and having no restriction on what you get. And I think when you go to a based on a true story, you're hemmed in by, you know, truth.
Yeah.
And what actually happened. And I'm not particularly interested in that. I tend to avoid stuff that's based on a true story. Well, so headlines.
That's one reason I spend so much of my time lying.
Yeah. Yes. I see that.
How did you feel about The Social Network and maybe Carlos? Has anyone here actually seen all 5 hours of Carlos?
No. The interesting thing about The Social Network is that they made it very clear at the beginning that they did not feel obligated to be truthful at all.
Yep.
Which on the one hand, I sort of understand. But on the other hand, if it were you, and it were your name and your face and your company, but they're saying, oh, hey, it's fictionalized, so we're not saying this is really what happened.
Well,
I would feel like you are taking some liberties with my existence.
I think on that movie in particular, the filmmakers tried to have it very much both ways. They had a source book that claimed that it was heavily researched and fact-based.
Right.
But then they said that we're going to take that as a starting point and make a dramatic story. And we're not really going to talk to you much about where we're fictionalizing. Well, we're just going to tell you a good tale.
They also changed a lot of the names. For example, the main character in that movie is named Flark Bruckerberg. And so you didn't necessarily know who they were talking about.
Yeah, well, and I guess, as a couple people pointed out, when objections were raised to the way that women were portrayed in this movie, Aaron Sorkin, who wrote the script, came out in a comment thread of a blog written by a TV writer and said, essentially, it's not my fault that the women are sort of, you know, ornamental and incidental to the story and treated like objects. That's the world I was portraying. That's how these guys really feel about women. So what was funny was,
I thought you were going to say, that's the world I live in.
No, no. What was funny about it is when it was convenient for them to say, well, yes, we made this up, but that's okay because we made it all up. Then all of a sudden it was made up.
Right.
But when
there
was something that offended people, then it was, well, we were stuck with that because this is the story as it happened. And it's like,
well, nobody ever said Aaron Sorkin wasn't a clever man with an argument.
That's, well, that's true.
But there are a lot of people who say, I'm not going to read fiction because anything can happen. I want to know. I go to memoir. Right. I go to autobiography. I go to history because I want it to know that it actually happened. That does not factor at all for me, because, I mean, just the act of imposing a narrative arc on something is fictionalizing.
Right.
Yeah.
And even if it's, you know, you spot check and you fact check within an inch of your life, you are still fictionalizing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You're telling a story. You're telling a narrative. And so all this stuff about, you know, well, he exaggerated here. This might be a little too insider baseball. But this whole ridiculous thing about David Sedaris,
mm-hmm,
and how much he's exaggerating and how much that, it doesn't matter to me at all,
right,
how true it is, because
I agree with that.
Tell me a good story.
And obviously the David Sedaris stuff came out originally at the same time as the James Fry stuff, or shortly after the James Fry stuff. The only time I care is when the very veracity of the story is the entire point of the sales, you know, effort is, mm-hmm, this is somebody telling you what
here
it's
is,
really
here is
like.
The gripping story of James Fry.
Here's the gripping story of how it really happens. Mm-hmm. Then I feel like you're in a different situation, as opposed to something like The Social Network, which I think is more kind of, here's sort of a version of this story which looks at it in a certain way, tries to bring out certain aspects. If you're talking about something where somebody says, here is a first-person account of what this thing is really like, this thing you don't hear about very often, like, here's what it's really like, then I care whether it's true. But I don't think that's what David Sedaris is doing. David Sedaris is not like, I'm doing an expose on families.
Right.
Like, that's not his thing.
He's burning through his sisters at a fast clip.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. That didn't mean a lot to me either. All right, so true stories, we like them, but not Glenn.
True.
Glenn hates childhood and truth.
Uh-huh. That's right. Yeah. Glenn hates Iron Man costumes. And anyway, so here's my next thing. Roger Ebert, who we have spoken about from time to time.
Yeah,
it's come
here
up in passing.
Wrote something recently explaining why he hates top 10 lists. Now, every now and then he gets called out as the guy who, you know, has cheapened film criticism forever by popularizing the thumbs up.
The tyranny of thumbs.
The tyranny of the tyranny of the thumbs and the stars and the grades and the whatever. Hates top 10 lists. What do we think?
I think Roger Ebert has been freed of the pressure to generate page views. And he acknowledges as much in that essay.
Yeah.
He says, you know, the reason that these top 10 lists exist, you know, the 10 most outrageous bloody blee and mm-hmm. the 10 reasons Sarah Palin mm-hmm. and Jon Stewart, you know, whatever mm-hmm. names generate gigantic amounts of
right.
page views.
10 reasons Bieber, Bieber, Bieber.
that he, you know, he's basically saying that the, you know, these are sort of shallow and reductive and they're only there to generate page views. And I will tell you, as somebody whose job in part
right
and only part of my job is to generate page views, I would respond to that, well, duh.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know,
that's like saying this is only something that happens on TV, this stunt is only to generate ratings. Well,
sure.
That is exactly the metric by which we're perpetuated in this business.
I am totally with both you and Ebert on this, and yet I will almost certainly edit a handful of these darn things within the next 2 months.
I will have to edit
sure.
30 or 40 of these
things.
They are
kind of a necessary evil. The audience just expects them at the end of the year, especially. You know what? It's like with Stray Cats. Once you give in to the impulse, you know, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, Linda Holmes has been known to do a list from time to time. You know,
well,
like
I do.
10 jobs that would not be a good career choice for Wolverine.
Yes,
like, you know,
I do.
Items like lingerie salesman and obstetrician and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
That's true. I guess I would distinguish, for the purposes of how I feel about these things, more as a reader than as a writer, because as a writer, you don't always get to write the things that you personally are most fascinated by. But, for example, if I'm writing something like, you know, 10 jobs not for Wolverine, that's a list in the sense that it's just a format. It's just a format of a way of making a
right.
bunch of jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the lists that tend to bug me are the lists where it's, you know, you have to go through 33 page views to see a list of 33
right.
things. And those are the ones where, to me, I begin to lose my patience.
Yeah.
And I think what he's talking about isn't just the list as a format. I'm not sure he's talking about either of those things. I think he's talking about the pointlessness of the top 10
list. Yeah. The idea that you can rank these things, that one thing needs to be better than the next.
Yeah,
right.
But the Ebert article didn't really register with me that much because I feel like I've read it before. I feel like I read it every year. It's the lead of every top 10 list.
Right.
I mean, every critic comes out and says
the lead is, I don't want to be doing this, but my boss made me.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
At least that's a subtext. And, and you can, I've just read it so many times.
Yeah. Well, and the other interesting thing about this that we've talked about before is that when you're reading criticism, rather than just saying, you know, does this person think you should go or not think you should go, one of the things that's most useful is to understand the sensibility of the
mm-hmm.
critic.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be that a top 10 list is at least a way to understand the sensibility of the critic, where even if it doesn't tell you what movies are good, maybe it tells you what kind of movies that particular critic
and that if you like eight, if you like eight of them and haven't seen two of them, that you would want to see the other two.
Right.
I mean, I take that point. I would still rather hear that argument or read that argument in an essay, I think. At some point, a list is about, if we're talking about a print publication, a list is just about making it easy for the audience to digest it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It restricts the critic from connective tissue to make fine points in the argument. And look, I worked for 5 years at USA Today, which is possibly the nation's chief evangelist of the bulleted item approach to news gathering, right?
Sure.
And I am not entirely convinced by the argument that people need what the people at USA Today like to call multiple points of entry to be able to comprehend things.
Right. Well, and we had a conversation last week, Trey, you and I, about the word listicle.
Yes, we did.
I thought we were going to make a
for
comment
which I
about
apologize.
The phrase multiple points of entry,
yes.
Which had me going,
No, listicle.
Listicle.
Which is also a little giggly.
Yes.
Listicle? Is that combining list and article?
Yes.
Or?
Yes, it's what, it's what you do when you can't be bothered to write something, you know, actually that has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Take the cojones.
Yeah, and that's... Nice. Obviously, some of them I think are delightful, and some of them are lots of fun.
Yes.
And I have certainly celebrated and recommended and linked to many a listicle in my life. I think there is a distinction, like I said, between the list as a format for just kind of throwing whatever.
Yeah, I mean,
out there.
The Wolverine jobs thing is sort of an example of a transparently not serious thing that is just about how good the jokes are.
Well, and that article was not the 10 definitive ways.
Well, but it is also true that sometimes you get these lists that are like, you know, 10 movies where a father does something bad. had. Mm-hmm. Right. And then it's, and you'll just be like, why do I need this list for anything? Yeah. The thing I like about the AV Club, which they had their inventory book, mm-hmm. the thing mm-hmm. I like about their list is that they tend to be really kind of oddball.
Yeah.
Like, they tend to be really sort of esoteric categories where you wouldn't necessarily think of it as a category in the first
place. And the thing
where you
can think of two, and then you have to think, well, I can think of two off the top of my head. I wonder what the others are.
Right.
Well, and the lists themselves are often sort of making commentaries on things.
Sure.
So it might be 10 movies in which dads at the end of the film throw their cell phone in the river as a gesture of, you know, improvement as a parent.
Right.
You know, or something like that, where they're commenting on a trope or...
Right. Yeah.
As much as the list is meant to generate page views, it's also meant to generate disagreement and people kind of being charming and saying, but actually,
And who doesn't love angry comments?
I thought it was interesting that you neglected to mention.
Ordinarily, I love what you do, but this time you've gone too far.
Yeah, it's true.
I note that you neglected to mention my blah, blah, blah. You noted that, did you? All by your big boy self? You noted that?
Yeah. Well, and it's the how could you possibly rank blah above blah. And that is a ranking thing that I do tend to stay away from myself, just because those things tend to seem like no-win situations.
Mm. I think this is a fine time to, in terms of a what's making us happy, a bonus round, to point out a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful article in McSweeney's. I think most of you have probably seen this, but it is called Great Literature Retitled to Boost Website Traffic.
Oh, no, I've not seen it.
And rather than do them all, I'll just give you my favorite one, which is 7 Awesome Ways Barnyard Animals Are Like Communism.
Well, it's very true. I can't argue. So, we have done James Franco. Mm. We have done Roger Ebert. Now, last night on AMC, they debuted The Walking Dead, which is their zombie show, which I know Mike is a big fan of. Mike Katziff, our producer, who's over there with a little smile on his face because he's a big fan. Now, I personally didn't see it, and I'm not expecting any of the rest of you to have seen it either.
No spoilers. It's on the TiVo.
We will give no spoilers. However, it had big ratings.
What, is it 5.3 million or something like that overnight?
Surprising.
Yeah, and here's what I'm thinking. How long can zombies possibly last?
Well, you have to lop their heads off.
I was going
to
say, the classic shelf life is, you know...
As a thing. I mean, you got your vampires.
Them with shovels.
You got your... But I mean, I finally feel like vampires are starting to leave. Mm-hmm. Right? How long are zombies going to hang around? That's my question. How long am I going to have to put up with zombies?
I think there have to be a bunch of really unpleasant, unfunny, uninteresting zombie products. I think I actually gave an interview.
I think eventually it'll just eat itself by uninteresting.
So to speak, it'll gnaw on its own brain. I gave an interview at one point, like a 45-minute interview about zombies versus vampires, and I don't even know why I was asked to do this interview. I think because we do this show or something. And one thing that I actually remember saying in this interview is that zombies are funnier than vampires.
Yes, because
it's an inherently more lighthearted...
Right, you can make a zombie comedy, right? Mm-hmm. But if you try to make a vampire comedy, you get Love at First Bite.
Yes.
Or Dracula Dead and Loving.
Yes.
I was a half second away from Dracula Dead and Loving.
And here's what I think. I think the problem is we don't have anything to take its place. I think the problem is we don't have something to come in and supplant zombies. I think the zombies supplanted the vampires, and now we got nothing to supplant the zombies.
Well,
there was supposed to be a little werewolf thing for a while, but
the remake
didn't take off, right?
Yeah. Here's what I think. Here's my idea.
Gotcha.
And see what you think. Skeletons in top hats with British accents.
All right.
I'm totally on monocles? Board with that.
That's my idea.
Do they have monocles and little
canes?
Canes.
And at some point, they will tap dance.
Yes. Uh-huh. Right. Yes. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm envisioning, as you can imagine, a kicking line of skeletons in top hats with British accents, monocles, and canes.
Absolutely.
Are we
on? Cut. Print.
Because I think unless someone steps forward...
Or lurches forward.
Staggers forward.
Or shuffles off to Buffalo forward to supplant the zombies. The zombies will not leave. So that's my idea.
Yeah.
So I saw that movie, Zombies Don't Leave. Very touching, heartfelt movie.
I'm thinking like mummies?
Mummy.
No. We had that franchise. Had that.
Mummies are right. That's true.
But the mummies never really went beyond the mummy, did they?
No.
The mummies are really just the mummy.
Yeah, it wasn't a thing.
Mummies are just dead things. Yeah. It's the same thing.
They just accessorize differently.
Yeah. Mummies are the same thing as zombies. Mm-hmm. They're just wearing.
I mean, there are enough variations on the zombie theme because it can sort of be everybody is infected with some sort of disease.
Right. Anything that can support everything from 28 Days and 28 Days Later to
Zombie
Pride and Prejudice and Zombies,
right. Yeah.
Is clearly something that's in a sweet spot for pop culture. And I'm not sure I understand what it is. I mean, there's been lots of conversation about the metaphors for...
Of course, were with vampires.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I really want to make this happen. I really want to make the skeletons and the top hats happen.
I think, look, instead of a complete shuffle off to Buffalo with like the exit music and everything, they need to start doing that and then collapse into a heap of bones.
Yes.
I will actually help finance that.
Okay, that's awesome. Because I think...
with all our money.
Yeah.
I think
what
would have to... The only thing that I need to do now is write the love story.
Right.
Where the skeleton in the top hat falls in love with like a librarian. In a small town in Maine, let's say.
she should appear plain until she takes off her glasses.
Right. She and like, pulls her hair out of a bun.
Right.
And
exactly.
Shakes her head.
So you're rewriting the ghost in Mrs. Muir with a skeleton.
I'm just saying. And I think that the skeleton would see the beauty in her and they would have a romance.
More important, she would see the beauty in the skeleton.
I was going to say, he must be bookish in some way. He must love... He must have
well,
a love
there is
of
the accent.
He must have a
the
love
accent.
Of reading.
I think he would have a love of reading. Mm-hmm. I think he would definitely have a love of reading. I don't understand.
So they could be like the Maxwell House commercials. Gradually they meet, cute. You should do... Tony Head should be the voice. He really should.
It's absolutely... That's perfect.
British?
I think this is a perfect idea.
Done and done.
All right. Something that is making you happy this week. I'm going to start with Thompson, who managed to stay relatively calm during that exchange. So he's probably most prepared to go forward.
All right. Well, there are several things that are making me happy.
Okay.
Do this in the spirit of bullet pointiness.
Yeah.
I will list these off in no particular order. One is that Brett Favre got to eat it again.
Oh, God's sake.
It's true.
On Sunday.
The one part of Brett Favre having to eat it that we cannot say we enjoyed is the part where he actually got hurt, because that's not cool.
Yeah,
that's
right. No. But he's not.
We can't
severely
be those people.
Injured.
So we're not glad that he got stitches in his face or anything.
No. I'm very sorry about the ankle. I'm very sorry about the face. I'm very sorry.
We're never
about,
happy about.
I'm sorry
actual
about the stigmata.
Injuries.
I'm sorry.
We just want to see.
Sorry,
grass.
He has to lug that old wooden cross by himself.
We just want to see turf in your face mask, right?
Yes, correct.
That's
and the team lose.
And the team lose, which they did. Again.
Anyway, so that's one thing. Another thing is that I finished The Hunger Games.
How did you like it?
I finished an entire book. I was halfway through and then just blazed through it in one.
Of course you did.
Because it is so fantastically good, and now I am ashamed to report that I have to buy two more books.
Did you enjoy? So you enjoyed it?
I loved it.
Were you right about it?
I completely and utterly
Excellent.
Loved it. Fantastic book. If you have not yet, on our recommendation, picked up The Hunger Games. I mean, it Costco, they've only printed 10 billion copies. If you go to Costco, there's like mammoth piles of it for like
$6. I did get one email this week from somebody who said, stop recommending The Hunger Games because the first two are really good, but the third one is terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm curious. I haven't read the third one.
Well, I heard the same thing about the Twilight books, where not
turns out that the last one's not as good.
That the first ones were good, but people saying like I would maybe read the first one for fun, maybe the second one for fun.
But then it goes to Crazy Town.
Beyond that, then you get into complete and utter crazy
I will say town. I've heard mixed things. I know people who love all three.
Okay,
but
excellent.
I will read them all regardless because I love the first one,
excellent.
And I'm not a book greedy type, as we've discussed.
You're not, but look how Stephen got into fiction. This is awesome.
Like
There's
I said,
one to grow
like
on.
I said, we're all we're all. Going to meet in the middle.
One to grow on, Thompson.
All you readers at home are going to get dumber and
so
dumber.
So happy for you.
Yeah. I'm also excited about the submissions that we have received in the request that we've sent out to our listenership to draw Chicktopus.
Mm-hmm.
For those who have not heard before, we requested that people draw the hybrid chicken octopus super beast that combines the abilities of and features of a chicken and an octopus.
Which was invented by you and your 9-year-old.
Yes, exactly.
Which was invented by you and your 9-year-old son during
the discussion
during a game, essentially.
During a game.
Are there any really disturbing Lovecraftian ones, or are they all
yes!
kind of cute?
Oh my God, they're so fantastic.
They're great.
We will eventually, once we get a few more of them, we will put together an amazing...
So keep them coming.
We're going to make a little slideshow.
Please feel free to continue.
We're going to make a little slideshow, but they are so great.
And the final thing that is making me happy, Mike, could you play the last thing that is making me happy?
You don't know it, but I made my mind up you'll wind up in my arms. First I have to break down your resistance to my charms. Yes, darling, I know it won't be easy, but I won't rest until I find a way. Everybody knows that Rome wasn't built in a day.
That is Nick Lowe performing, and I know I'm totally astroturfing here and plugging our own products, but that is the Nick Lowe Tiny Desk Concert recorded at the NPR Music Offices. I seriously wanted to cling to his ankles in an effort to keep him from leaving.
It was pretty great.
It's just like being serenaded by your kindly misanthropic uncle.
It was great.
And just absolutely wonderful.
It was a really good day to be in the room that day.
Well, yeah, and we haven't put this one on the site yet. We had Richard Thompson on the same day. But the Nick Lowe, I mean, we've done more than 100 of these Tiny Desk concerts where we have our favorite musicians come in and perform at the desk of NPR host Bob Boylan, which happens to be in the same large bullpen area where Linda sits and where Trey sits and where I sit. And just that particular one, I really, really wanted to call attention to it because it's so wonderful, and it's kind of in the spirit of a little bit of a postscript to what Linda was talking about a couple weeks ago with Marshall Crenshaw in terms of these very, very sort of wise, understanding friend kind of singer-songwriters. Mm-hmm. And Nick Lowe is a particular favorite of mine, and that one, boy, just don't miss it.
Yeah, I would agree. How about you, Glenn Weldon?
Well, mine's pretty talky, go figure. So Mark Maron's podcast, WTF. Now, as you can probably tell from the name, it contains strong language as opposed to...
A Mark Maron podcast contains strong language?
Yeah. So if you blanch at the Anglo-Saxon term for the physical act of love, this is not this is not your podcast. A comedy nerd, I am. I listen to a lot of comedy podcasts. I love them all. You're Never Not Funnies, your Jordan Jesse Goes, your Comedy Death Ray, which I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what happens on a lot of them is that comedians come on and they do bits. They do shtick. They do shtick bits. They
shtits.
I could go for some shtits right about now. The Maron podcast started out like that. The comedians would come on. They'd riff. Gradually, and we're about probably up to 60 or so by now, it has morphed into something a lot more intimate, a lot more serious, and it almost, we get into the craft of stand-up a lot, but we also, each comedian comes on, it's almost like a therapy session.
Maron
is a funny guy, and he kind of owns the fact that he and his fellow comics tend towards self-involved, tend towards self-obsessed, and so when a comic comes on the show, they tend to talk about Maron, specifically to talk about what a jerk Maron was in the 90s when he was doing a lot of coke and drinking a lot. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of get through it. The thing about this show, the hallmark of it, is its honesty. And it's not this kind of D-baggy, self chest pumping kind of like, sure. I just say like it is. You got to deal with me.
Keeping it real.
It's a lot more self-aware than that. It's almost cripplingly self-aware. but there is honesty. He'll have a Carlos Mencia come on to defend accusations that he steals jokes. Ooh. He'll have a Dane Cook come on to defend accusations that he's kind of a tool. and when he doesn't respect a comedian, this is what I'm talking about in terms of honesty, when he doesn't respect a comedian, it is very apparent. It's not a show-busy interview show at all.
Right.
It becomes a little uncomfortable. There's no politesse, but when he finds someone who he regards as a kindred spirit, when he recognizes some of his own hang-ups in the other person, this amazing thing happens where you feel a lot of this bitterness and resentment sort of melting away. I recommend the episodes he did with Dana Gould, who was a very funny stand-up comic in the 90s.
Yes, yes.
Who went away for about 10 years to become a producer on The Simpsons. He comes back. Now he's out kind of trying to find his voice again as a stand-up. Sure. Hmm. And those two just kind of had this great... meeting of the minds. Louis C.K., who used to be his best friend, then some emails weren't sent. And that, you know, and this resentment built up on both of them.
There's a shock, those two guys.
Wow. I know, right?
Oh,
and then just recently, Ira Glass was on, and Ira Glass, obviously not a comic, but the conversation they had was very intense. You hear Maron going to the interview saying he resents Ira Glass for everything being so polished and perfect, and, you know, he doesn't feel like he really gets to know this guy, and, you know, and he really respects this American life. And they talk about that. And Marin gets some honest things in, and Glass gets some things in, and you start to learn about their processes and how similar these two are in a way.
Like, the easiest kind of interaction I have is the conversations I have in making the stories for the show.
Right.
I mean, other conversations I'm fine with. Like, I adore the people I work with. I'm not crazy. Like I'm close to people, but I know that the easiest, then often the most fulfilling, and usually the longest conversations of my day are the ones that happen when I'm getting tape.
Yeah. And when you were...
in a way, the most intimate.
Absolutely. I feel that way with crowds. I'm more intimate and more emotionally open with crowds and with people I talk to on the show than I am in my personal life. My personal life's a disaster, emotionally, in a lot of ways. And it just... I guess this is the reason why we pick this to be our life's work. And the reason why it functions for us is that we are able to get out of ourselves.
It's just fascinating, occasionally funny, but mostly fascinating stuff. So that's Mark Maron's podcast, WTF.
Maron is a super, super, super smart guy, mm-hmm. and every bit as neurotic as advertised in mm-hmm. the 4 or 5 times. I mean, I haven't talked to him in ages, but in the time that I've spent with him, he is every bit that guy.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Trey?
I, too, like Stephen Thompson, have brought a singer-songwriter to cap it all off.
Is it Brett Favre?
It is not.
Super Bowl shuffle?
Brett Favre is not involved. First of all, I would like to say that I am being made happy by our audience.
Oh, yes.
Which, in addition to submitting various Chictopus sketches, our audience apparently is terribly, terribly clever because, among other things, they speak Finnish. And one of them not only listens in English and then writes about us in Finnish, there's another whole person who speaks Finnish and translated the original Finnish thing.
Last week, we had read a blog post that was written about the podcast that we were trying to figure out what it meant, because when we ran it through Google Translator, it came back saying something about putting the end cap on this business trip, which...
And also our buttons on people's ears.
Yes. And if you read the comments to last week's Pop Culture Happy Hour, the previous episode to this one, you can see that someone was kind enough to translate and explain that it was really just a series of very nice and friendly compliments, which we were pretty sure it was probably not hostile.
Right, right.
But we did not know exactly what was meant by putting the end cap on this business trip.
And, we actually looked up the word D-bags in Finnish and determined there wasn't a match.
It was not
true. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Trey.
But then also, earlier this week, I believe someone tweeted in Glenn's general direction an answer to what was troubling him about that terrible Brombone song.
They did.
And the answer involved something called the Neapolitan chord.
They did.
Which means that it's made up of 3 parts and you leave one in the container.
The strawberry.
One you never touch.
Lady.
Hi-yo.
Oh, Glenn Weld. You delight me. But I think what was interesting about that was that this person vindicated what you had said, which is there is something peculiar about that particular chord.
Right, something designed in that moment to trouble you.
That made it unusual.
And he gave it an example.
He did. He gave an example. So we have excellent, excellent...
Yes, indeed.
Excellent listeners, and we love them.
And if you would like to join the chorus of those people and write your own comments,
all
of the episodes of Pop Culture Happy Hour are in one incredibly handy and easy to remember place.
That's
if you
true.
Go to npr.org/PCHH or npr.org/PCHH. Then you can join in the discussions.
And you can tell us whether you're in favor of truth or fiction or lists.
That's right true. Or childhood.
Yes. Now, the actual substantive thing, not that our audience is not, that's making me happy this week, the thing that I came prepared to talk about. It is November. We are here in the early bits of November, and the air has turned cold and crisp. And as I do around this time every year, I dug this thing up on YouTube today.
But I miss you. Most of all, my darling, when autumn leaves start to fall,
Eva Cassidy, of course, singing Autumn Leaves. I wanted you to hear the piano solo in particular, because it turns out there is an awesome story connected to this piano solo. This was recorded live at Blues Alley right here in Washington, D.C., not too terribly long before Eva Cassidy died, if I remember correctly. She died in 1996 of cancer. She was 33. It's available on YouTube, first of all. And she's so shy, and she's sort of into this performance in what looks to be such a total way. She's just a lady singing a song with her guitar, and she's right there by herself. You think maybe she's not even really aware of the crowd, or she's trying to hide from the crowd. And then at 2 minutes and 45 seconds into this YouTube video, she opens her eyes back up, and she shoots a look off to the side, and that's when the piano solo starts. And it turns out that the look is her saying, "I want the piano interlude now," because they hadn't rehearsed it. And she's giving the piano guy a cue. She had just called him up that night and said, "I want you to play with me on stage tonight. We're recording this for the album, and I want you to play with me." And according to the story, the way it's told on evacassidy.org, he had missed an earlier opportunity to come in. And it was in a very difficult key for him. It's in 5 flats, if anybody listening knows what we're talking about. And apparently he was sort of terrified about blowing the gig because he knew they were recording it for the album, and he missed his entrance. And she apparently didn't have an instrumental solo prepared on her guitar because she wasn't the world's greatest guitarist. And so she sort of gives him this look and says, "I need you now." And he improvises this piano solo on the spot. And then he sort of gets back out, and she finishes the song alone with her guitar. And it is one of the loveliest things that's available to listen to this time of year, and I'm just particularly fond of it.
Oh.
Yeah, I need to spend a little bit more time with Eva Cassidy's music, because I've bought a couple of her records because there was so much talk of her surrounding her death. And I've always found her records very, very overproduced and just haven't been able to really dig in. And I don't know if I've bought the wrong records. I mean, if people want to write in the comments and recommend a specific recording, but I really like what I just heard.
Cool. Wow. Well, this is going to make mine sound unbelievably dumb.
Mine is that I discovered a new kind of tube of toothpaste.
Not quite, but close. Mine is tangentially related to the fact that I have recently joined the ranks of the people with the fancy smartphones.
Fanfan.
Fanfan, yeah. And without getting into it, I will say it is not an iPhone. Now, this, of course, as I think many people who obtain this kind of device will tell you, immediately changed my life and so forth. Yeah, you immediately don't know how you ever lived without it, blah, blah, blah. But what I have not really gotten into yet on it is games. And I tried the Angry Birds game, right? Do you play the Angry Birds?
Yes.
I do not.
Yes.
I know somebody who went as an Angry Bird for Halloween.
Nice.
Wow.
I don't get the Angry Birds.
Really?
I tried the Angry Birds. To me, that was so dumb, right? To me, I was like,
send your emails to
no. I'm
this
not
is
saying,
a little like bailing
on.
At the dwarf tea party.
hang on.
A lot of different birds. A lot
hang
of different
on.
Birds doing a lot of different stuff.
I'm not saying
I bet the iPhone version of the Angry Birds is awesome.
Oh, quiet. I'm not saying the people who like it are dumb. I'm saying to me the game was just. I kept thinking, is this all there is to this game? Is this this is the whole game, is firing the birds at the thing.
How many birds did you get through, Linda?
Not very many.
All right.
Not very many.
Page 4, I believe.
Really?
Not very many. But here's the other thing. If you download the free one, at least, you get ads in the middle. And
I wouldn't know about that.
And from my perspective, it was so obvious that they would have an incentive to essentially fix it so that you wouldn't finish the level, so they had to watch more ads. Do you know what I mean? That I couldn't trust a game that inserted ads in the middle of the game such that you would see more ads if they made it harder. Because I think that explains why it was so hard. So anyway, this got me thinking about the fact that I am clearly an unsophisticated person with regard to games, because what I do like is I have a free game that I got from my Kindle. You can play games on your Kindle. Many people did not know that.
As you have mentioned once or twice.
Although I'm just guessing that the refresh rate on the Kindle means that you always don't whack them all.
Yeah. Well, and they're not likely to be, speed games, but I have recently gotten into this game. It's one of these games where they start you off with a bunch of jumbled letters and you have to find all the words.
Ah, yes.
And the most important goal that will get you to the next level is to find the longest word, which is always the word that uses all the letters. And this game I can play for like an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. This game I can sit there finding little words in a bigger group of letters forever. But, you know, give me a fancy game with great graphics that everyone else loves, like Angry Birds, and I'm like, meh. Give me like a...
Oh, my God. You know, if you found for the iPhone a perfect simulation of exactly the version of Oregon Trail that I played in seventh grade, mm-hmm. I would pay $10 for it. Mm-hmm. But no, there's like...
You can play Oregon Trail on Facebook.
But yeah, but it's like there's some like, oh, super fancy Oregon Trail with like cartoons. I don't want the... I was really channeling Glenn there. That was exactly really a Glenn was. Voice I was making.
It really was. But, it's but, a compliment.
No, I meant it.
In fact, I'm offended that there's not a Trey voice yet.
Oh, there is.
There is. Oh, good.
You kidding. Haven't heard me do that? Oh, I guess you haven't.
Oh, this will be fun sometime. We should all just sit around and do this. Can you tell who's speaking now?
Oh, my God.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. I want exactly the games that I have enjoyed playing. Like, I want a version of Minesweeper that I played on an Apple IIc.
Yeah.
You know, when it was on the Apple IIc. I don't need fancy Minesweeper. I just want Minesweeper.
And like I said, there are all these incredibly... like complicated games on Facebook where you have to leave people things and buy things and accumulate things.
You are speaking of the bane that is Farmville.
Farmville, but there are lots and lots of them. There are lots of these games, right? What do I love playing on Facebook? Family Feud. They have a version of Family Feud on Facebook that I play, and my sister and I complete each other's fast money rounds. So it really is Family Feud, because we're in the same family.
That's true. Is there a virtual Richard Dawson giving everybody virtual mono?
No, there's not, but the funniest part is, you know how they would always, if they revealed the answer, like a dog, the audience would say, dog! Which is always like the stupidest part. Because they don't obviously have a recording of crowd voices yelling every single answer that they reveal, they have the crowd say, oh yeah. So it'll, every time it goes ding, this recording of the crowd goes, oh yeah. And so then another one goes ding, oh yeah. So anyway, I love playing Family Feud on Facebook. I love free games for my Kindle, and Angry Birds goes completely over my head.
It's just too high concept.
So what's making me happy is games for simpletons. Because ultimately I am a simpleton. That brings us to the end of another Pop Culture Happy Hour. And you can follow all of us on Twitter and keep up with our various happenings. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, which is...
Don't do it.
What? Why?
Okay.
Why?
Trey with an E, then Graham like the cracker.
And you can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can also follow our illustrious producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, we should mention, provides our awesome in and out music, which you're probably listening to as I am speaking. So thanks to everybody. Thanks to all of you guys for coming by.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
And joining me for another Pop Culture Happy Hour. And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you next week.